those who struggled to sing along with it, I should point out that it was the German version and you hadn't forgotten the words, if it happened to be a family favourite. Northside Radio FM 99.3, and a moment ago we just welcomed Leon Saunders, an author amongst many other things in his life. So good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Is ABBA one of your favourites? You can be honest here. We have devotees and we have those who say...
I love ABBA.
Oh,
that's Muriel's Wedding is one of the best films ever.
And are you aware, let's test your general knowledge on ABBA. From what country do all four members come from?
Sweden.
Three of them come from Sweden. Did you know that?
Rats.
Yeah. One Norwegian, three Swedish. How did they get away with that for so long? Now, Leon, before I ask you about your book, The Gaze of Dogs, there's a long history before you got to writing a novel, but you've been writing for a long time.
Yeah.
How would Australians best know your work?
Probably from Home and Away, because it's the most well-known show, but yeah. I wrote lots of others too. Flying Doctors. I started on Cop Shop, if anybody remembers that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that with the popular programs like the Home and Away, that there's a few ways that people listen to it? They listen to it, you know, for the entertainment at night time, they're getting the dinner, etc. But that over time they actually develop a real affection for some key characters. They start to see connections and with events that are going on with their own lives. It's a little bit more to it than...
Absolutely. And not only Australians, but overseas people too. We met two policemen in Scotland last year who were thrilled when they found out that I'd written Home and Away. They wanted to ask me for my autograph. I had to tell them, look, nobody asks the writer for his autograph. Some of them can't even write.
Yeah. And in terms of the what's the big kind of focus for you? Is it the plot, or is it just the nuances of the character? I mean, you've got to be very careful with these characters, haven't you? You can't just suddenly dump a script or an idea on them that's not going to suit.
Yes, I would say people become very attached to the characters, you know, and probably that reminds them of somebody that they knew in their family or things like that. And we tend to try to keep it in character. It's very important in writing scripts to make sure that the dialogue is suitable for the characters at all times.
And you learn to speak like them, don't you?
I hope not.
I just mean
in some cases.
Just for the script.
Yes, you do. Okay. I know what you mean.
And I mean, that must have been very satisfying. Flying Doctors as well had a little bit more of a theme of the kind of issues that medical issues in a subtle way, but carries messages as well, of health messages as well, along the way.
Absolutely. Flying Doctors and also Country Practice that I wrote for about 12 years. We had to have a new illness every week. And the old saying was that you wouldn't want to go to Wandon Valley because you either get sick or you die.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose so. You'd have to. Is that where Cop Shop came in? Lots of inquiries as to.
Yes, I guess so. I guess so. But my GP, for instance, said she had to watch a Country Practice because she knew on Tuesday morning all half her patients were going to come in with symptoms that they'd seen on Country Practice.
Did it ever happen in real life that it actually did trigger an awareness of something serious? I mean, I take it that a lot of that was just imagination or fear, but it must have sometimes triggered an event where someone says that puts me over the line to ask about.
It may well have done so, but they also used it. It was used by the community, if you like. At one point, the eye hospital needed donors for corneal transplants. So we devised a story that involved that illness, and they devised a whole campaign around the characters in Country Practice. So, you know, soap is going to be very useful in that respect.
And there are a lot of approaches like that, a lot of connection with other bodies or with the community organisations to keep it relevant?
I had a friend, a psychologist, who came to me and said, look, we've just done a survey and found out that an alarming number of young people are terrified that there's going to be a nuclear war. This was quite some years ago.
Yeah.
Could you write a program that would sort of address that issue? So we did. So we decided that one of the kids in the class at school was very disturbed, and he found out that he had terrible nightmares about the world blowing up. So the kids said, what are we going to do about it? And said, well, we'll raise awareness by having a big rock concert, and we'll have to have somebody really important to come along. Who will it be? So we racked our brains, and then somebody jokingly said, well, what about Bob Hawke? You know, and he said, yeah, but who would you get to play him? And then somebody else said, well, how about asking him? So we did, and within about 10 minutes, I exaggerate a little bit, but he said, yeah, okay. So they did the concert out near Windsor where the airport was. They flew him in. He came and appeared. He's the only Prime Minister that I know of who has actually appeared in an episode of a soapy in Australia.
But I can imagine him, and I can actually imagine other Prime Ministers, absolutely being thrilled to be taken out of their comfort zone and thinking, this really does matter. This is...
And getting lots of...
Yep, yep.
Free publicity.
Absolutely. No problem with any of that. But actually wanting to do it anyway. Just like... thanks that somebody asked me to do something for an objective good. They didn't ask me to do it to promote something or whatever. It's actually a good use of office and all that.
Yep.
I'm speaking with Leon Saunders. We're going down a little bit of a history about some of the important cultural writing that has happened in this country, and that was a TV. And, of course, now have you jumped ship, gone in a new direction, developed it? What took you to – this is your first novel. You've written in other ways, but
it is
your first actual novel.
Yes.
The Gaze of Dogs. What took you to that as a means or as a method?
I think I'd always thought that I was going to be a novelist, and it was always in the back of my mind. And then as I got older, I got aged out of the writing profession on TV. It's a very ageist business. And I was getting a bit tired of it.
Just on that, that seems really odd that it would be ageist if you're a writer, that I... That a mix of writers from young to old, 8 to 80, would 9 to 90, whatever, would be better than... Why would it be ageist?
Try telling that to the producers.
Okay.
The Writers Guild Western America had a campaign to try and persuade producers to... They took a producer to court because he had boasted that there was no one on his writing staff over 40 years of age.
Okay. That sounds like a very... doubtful business model to me.
Yeah, that's right. But there was one lovely old lady who was giving evidence. She'd been writing forever. And they said to this producer, well, you know, why do you need all these young people? And he said, well, because only young people know how to write the young language, you know. And this old lady said, I don't have to be a dog to write Lassie. And that sums it up, I mean,
that's just professionalism, that you don't have to be... You don't have to be a police officer to be play as an actor a police officer.
You have an ear for it. Yeah.
No, that's odd, but if that happens, so you focused more on the journey of becoming an author in a novel. Are you one of those guys that annoyed everybody at dinner by writing on napkins when you had a thought?
No.
I mean, I've got to say, I perfectly respect it. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's true. No, I was too busy eating and drinking.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's another way of going about it. Okay. So The Gaze of Dogs, it's a pretty, it's a bit of a confronting cover, I have to say. It's got a strong dog theme.
Many other words used to describe it.
Dog theme coming at you. No mistake about it. It's got a bit of a dog theme, but it's an earlier journey than that. Without sort of, probing, there must have been some kind of thread that took you there, some reason why that story was one to tell.
It came out of my experiences on the Anarchy Sapphire, that's A-N-A-K-I-E, Anarchy Sapphire mining fields in central Queensland in the 70s, where I wound up by accident, really.
Yep. Just tell us a little bit about those, because I get the impression that there's a sort of a special quality to that was... in background for you, it wasn't just happened to be there, it was a real context.
Absolutely. I walked into the Anarchy pub a couple of days after I'd arrived there, and the first thing I noticed was that there was a big hole in the wall of the fibro wall in the pub. And I said to the publican, how did that happen? He said, some silly bugger rode a horse in here for a bet and it kicked out and knocked a hole in the pub. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you wouldn't see that in the Four in Hand in Paddington.
Not often.
No.
Well, I don't know.
I knew I was somewhere special, my friend, about that.
Yeah. And but that's not the reason you stayed there, I'm hoping. So what was it about the area that took you there?
It's one of the reasons I stayed there because, as I said, I realised it was somewhere special, somewhere very different. And I was intrigued by the people. I was also intrigued by the possibility that maybe I would sort of make a huge fortune mining sapphires. There were a lot of people scratching around then.
Mm-hmm. And... what took you from that kind of context? I mean, were the people much different other than the guy who rode the horse through there on that occasion? Did you find the nature or the people that you're dealing with stood out in some way? Or
there were all sorts of different people. I mean, they came from all walks of life and from all over the country. There was a bunch of people there they called the League of Nations. They also called them the Scrub Elkies because they were a bit involved in Bundaberg Rum. But there was a couple there, an English couple who had a good job. He'd worked for Ampol, I think, and they came for a visit to the gem fields one weekend and they said, we'd like to live here. He gave up his job and they came out and he bought a tractor and he started mining with himself and his three children.
Okay. And did they go well?
Yeah. Yeah, they did well. And they stayed there for years and years and years.
So they sort of did and they sort of didn't pan the place.
Oh, very good.
And we're speaking with Leon Saunders about his book, The Gaze of Dogs. But before we got there, we took a course in important Australian culture, country practice, other gems like that. But this is a different kind of gem that you're looking for in Queensland. You've met up with some potential neighbours that drive their horses through hotels, pan for whatever, and come to all sorts of mishaps. I'm thinking there's a couple of steps I haven't found that has taken you from that environment where you might be too reluctant to look up, or might think you need to look up to actually want to go head down and write a novel. So what's pushed you into that and pushed you into this particular story? We'll come to the actual story in a sec, but what's pushed you beyond that?
My experiences on the gem field were actually what drove the book. When I came out of there and I knew that I was going to write a book, I thought, well, what better subject matter to use than something that is exotic that nobody else has ever experienced before and a whole heap of characters that are just ready-made to go into a novel. So that was where I started.
From the gem fields, you mean?
From the gem fields, yes.
Is that because the gem fields is such a sort of a... it's an aspirational, but it's got tragedy. You don't go there if life's easy, but you hope for something much better. And within 5 minutes, you might think it's time to give up or you've struck it rich.
Yes, that's part of it. We mined for a little while and we hit a really rich pocket. That was really exciting. But more than that was the lifestyle. I think it was after you'd been there for a while, it got in your blood. The lifestyle, I mean, not the actual mining. Yeah. It was just so free. Everybody, there was a lot of wild and woolly characters there, but we all got along pretty well. There wasn't much lawlessness there. It was a pretty sort of Wild West frontier mentality, but they all got along well.
How are you going about your mining? Is it the classic old-fashioned panning? Is it a high-tech thing?
No, there's actually no panning for it. That's gold. You could either do it with a bulldozer with a big cut, or you could do it with a pick and shovel like they used to in the early days in the beginning of the 20th century. We used a jackhammer and wound it up on a windlass with buckets, and then we processed it with a machine called a Willoughby in a big tank of water.
And how does it go down if you do find something? Is it a general celebration amongst all, or is it a sort of a... an us and them kind of thinking? How does it
Well, you keep it pretty quiet.
Yeah.
Because you don't want someone coming over ratting your wash, as I say. You would have a bit of a celebration.
Yeah.
Because you might have worked for 2 months and barely tucker money, as they called it, and then you hit a rich pocket. And that'll keep you going through the next sort of lean months. But at least you get the sense of excitement digging by hand, though, that if you do it with a bulldozer, it's just $20 per yard. You don't see those rich pockets. It gets pushed up with a bulldozer.
Yeah, yeah. And was there a tipping point? Was there a point at which you thought, no, my theme, I've got my backdrop, I've got my characters, but the way in which there's a particular search involved, there's a particular journey that your character takes, what took you to that theme as opposed to something else?
To be honest, that was somebody who helped me with the editing of the book because it was one of the early problems of the book was it didn't have that mission. The guy wasn't there on a search. He wound up there by accident on the gem fields, which is what happened to me. But that wasn't good enough for a drama.
So you were kind of at first drafting, you were more in the context of this fantastic environment. You're conveying that to your readers, but they need a hook of one person, which narrows it down a bit. It makes it that's the big challenge, isn't it, in a novel to get a kind of a theme that's going to bring all those other bits together.
It is, and that's something I had to invent. I was relying too heavily on what had actually happened, so I was just describing all the events. I just thought it would be enough to string together a whole lot of events, like a guy riding a horse into the pub and like a guy blowing the veranda off the pub because he got banned. So he took a couple of sticks of jelly and blew the veranda off the pub.
So you were letting the facts get in the way of a good story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real, for those who are listening who are budding authors, that is a real author issue, isn't it? That you're making it incredibly accurate. There's a lot to be gained. You get a lot of knowledge out, a lot of perception out of it, but somehow you're not in the shoes of a particular person to walk that walk with you. And so, what is your character? What tell us about your character, the sort of person that people meet in this book.
Are the characters that they will meet in the book?
No, the main.
The central character.
Yeah.
he's a young guy. It's a rites of passage story, really.
Yeah.
But whereas initially I had him just turning up on the Gemfields by accident, which is what happened to me, it had to go further than that. So it winds up being a mission for him to find out who his parents were. He doesn't know.
That's a story that has some sensitivities in it, doesn't it, for readers? Because they may have been through that themselves. They don't know their heritage, or it's been obscured or misled to them, out of good, bad, or indifferent reasons. There's a lot of people in that situation, aren't there, just trying to get a handle on what happened before?
I guess so. And yes, I suppose I'm one of those as well. And even though I wasn't really looking for my past parents, I probably was looking for something. I was a lost soul.
When it was suggested to you that you have a key character bring these threads together, did you feel it worked for you too, as a partly as an author, but also as the living it and the whole story itself, that it was actually working and drawing it together?
Did I feel
that it really helps for you to tell that story and to feel that story yourself?
Yes, it did. This person that I mentioned, her name is Chris McCourt.
Yep.
It was very, very helpful. She read the early drafts and said, look, this is very well written, but the story sucks. She denies to this day that she used those words, but she did, and I wasn't the least bit offended. It was the best thing anybody could have said to me. But yes, then I started to look inside myself, and I found what might have driven this guy to deliberately go to the Gemfields rather than just to wind up there by accident.
Yeah, to a certain extent, that's being a little bit hard on yourself as well, isn't it? To say, look, okay, I can't just be superficial. I've got to dig deeper with me, with my character, with my writing.
Yes. You have to be true to yourself.
And that's just because sometimes we have those who are interested in the creative process listening. They might be musicians, they might be authors, in any different way. It's a tough call, but you do have to do it, isn't it? You take your draft and you have to keep the core that matters, but you have to get it rid of something that you prized.
You have to learn how to kill your babies, as they say.
Sorry, okay. Very elegantly put.
You know what I mean.
But you didn't learn that on Country Practice. But nevertheless, that's hard, isn't it?
Yep.
And you could fight back and say, I want to keep it, but it's not.
That was one of the disciplines that I learned from writing television scripts.
Yeah.
You learn to be pretty thick-skinned. Because they're not, you don't have much control as a writer when you're writing for series and serials television. The first editing session I had with a guy on Cop Shop, I remember it was the editing session was done by phone, and he said, "Well, I'd like to take this out and that out and this out." And I said, "Oh, I'd really like to keep those." And I was fighting to keep everything in, and in the end, he said, "Well, if you don't take it out, I will." And that's when I realised the reality of being edited on TV.
Well, because one of the things you do have when you're writing what we call the soaps is that people half know your character from last week. So you've got to, in a novel, introduce your character, develop them and bond with your reader in one hit. That's a bit of a challenge, I would have thought.
It is, and you need to get into the story pretty quickly. You don't want to lose them in the first five pages. You've got to grab them right up front, and that is one of the problems, yeah.
Speaking with Leon Saunders, Northside Radio FM 91.3, his book is The Gaze of Dogs. So what would your ideal reader seem like to you? Is there a particular demographic? Is there a kind of a sense of readership or those who connect to your style of storytelling more than others?
I suppose it's an outback story. I imagine people who, older people who were brought up on Henry Lawson and Barbara Bainton and Badger Patterson might see that aspect of it in it. But then on another level, there are the people who will identify with, as we said before, somebody who is a bit of a lost soul, looking for their past.
And without sort of leaking stories and things that are best to discover as you read the book, what is the journey that your main character is making, and what is he searching for and hoping to find?
He's searching for his past. He has no recollection of his early childhood. I won't reveal any more than that.
But we're talking about an actual period of time in his life that isn't known. He's only got very few clues.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's part of a sense of wanting to belong and knowing where you came from, but also, like what's important in my life and all that sort of thing, that you have to do that. That's what I thought is your character conveys pretty soundly, that that's a bit of a mixed journey. Like, it's not like an investigative effort it's more like a, you know, do I want to know this or do I not want to know this? Mixed feelings kind of inquiry.
Exactly right. I mean, part of the story is, of course, that he changes while he's there. And while he is on a mission to discover something, he learns all sorts of different things and lessons in life from the other people that he meets there. So he comes out of it a completely different person than he went into it.
In terms of the sort of discussions that your character has with trying to find out what happened in his life, it's not, as I say, it's not the real investigative sort of approach, but it's got a bit of an analogy to those difficult conversations people make in their lives or in their families or all that sort of stuff to try and find out a little bit more what's causing things to tick, not literally just what are these facts, but why are things as they are. Difficult conversations that unravel. Is that something, is that a kind of a theme or is that just a subset of a particular character?
I think I wouldn't call that a theme of this one. I think the theme more is the disparity, the different kinds of people that he meets and the different ways they use to overcome their own particular problems.
And you get a little bit of a latitude, I guess, by the robust environment in Queensland that you depict, because there are just, a lot of rich characters to draw on there to throw a few uncertainties into the mix.
Yeah, that, exactly right. And he came to appreciate bush ethics, if you like. For instance, I decided to burn off around the little hut that I was living in one day to keep the snakes away. And it got away on me. The wind started blowing in the wrong direction. It caught fire to this little bough shelter that I had my veggies growing under, and my house was at risk. And there was no running water, no hoses to put it out, so I picked up a sugar bag and was beating it out. And I heard a voice from over near the gateway saying, "You want a hand?" And it was my nearest neighbour, Tommy Walker. And I said, "Yes, Tom, for God's sake." So he rushed in then and picked up. But the point I'm making is you had to go through that protocol first in the bush. You know, he wouldn't presume to just rush in that I couldn't handle it myself.
Yeah.
You'd have to ask the question, "You want a hand?" And as soon as I said yes, he leapt into action.
Yeah, because I wouldn't be offended. I mean, if I was having trouble with a fire and snakes coming at me, I wouldn't be offended by people thinking that I was going to struggle with that issue. I didn't want to offend, you know. I thought you could handle it. But it's just where
etiquette, bush etiquette.
Somebody started opening fire on you, then I thought, better kick in. Leon Saunders is our prisoner in the studio, and he's been talking about his first novel, The Gaze of Dogs. Leon, it's a big thing, writing a book. It takes a bit out of you, and it's a personal challenge. At the end of all of that, where are you? You left collapsed, exhausted, satisfied, or absolutely wanting to get back into your next novel?
It took place over a long period of time, so yeah. I think there was a sense of relief and a sense also of I'm not going to go through this again. But now that we've sort of got to the stage with this one and it's being published, I am keen to get into the next one, which is even bigger.
Even bigger. And is it your passion to keep writing, or at least for the moment keep writing in this kind of, what would you say, it's historical, historical fiction, based on fact, but it's a personal story as well. It's not
fiction,
entirely.
Like, yeah. The next one is a historical novel, and it's not based on any personal experience.
But that could change as you write it, do you think?
Maybe.
Okay. That's not giving too many clues away. And so let me conclude today asking you. It's a bit of a challenge. You've got to put your hand up to be a published author. You don't really know where that journey will take you. And there must be many who start that journey and decide to stop for good, bad, or indifferent reason. What did you find worked for you? What encouragement worked for you? What would you offer to others who are interested in writing but perhaps don't quite feel the confidence to get past the next hurdle?
I would say start earlier than I did.
Yeah.
If you really want to be a novelist. I had a fantasy in my mind that writing novels wasn't all that hard. It is very hard, and you need to work really hard at it, and real novelists do that every day, and they can write 10 or 12 novels in a lifetime.
Is that because they don't realise how much of it will be trimmed away constantly, or they think they can just write from A to Z?
It would be different for every person. In my case, I had difficulty with story structure that we've covered earlier.
Yeah.
That was my big problem, but everybody will have problems. And it's just, look, it's practice, practice, practice. The more you write, and read a lot.
Yeah.
The more you read, the better you're going to write.
Who are your favourite authors now?
Cormac McCarthy springs to mind. And some of the older guys, I suppose. I mean, Herman Melville and people like that. James Joyce, actually. I mean, that sounds a bit pretentious, but I won a writing competition and I was obliged to read Ulysses. And I did, and I discovered
everyone's obliged
I actually
to
enjoyed
read
it.
Ulysses. And Peter Carey's given you a pretty good wrap-up.
Yes, yes, he's a personal friend, yeah. and he is very helpful in the writing of it too, but more in a sense of style, yeah. Whereas the other person I mentioned, Chris, was structure.
If you look back over the help that you got, the most helpful comments that you got that might be just of more general application than just the particular work they were looking at, what was the sort of thing that you found was the most helpful guidance you got?
Peter always kept telling me, like a mantra, keep it in the moment. Keep it in the moment.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's what I asked him.
Yeah.
But I think I know now.
Yeah.
You just don't wander off. That to always sort of keep the central story in the back of your mind, even if nothing is directly related to it at the time. Everything has to relate to that journey, that thread that's going through it.
And that's a real change of the way we normally think, isn't it? Because normally if we're there, we think, well, there are distractions coming at us. We might go this way or that way.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of discipline.
Yes, it does. Yes, you have to keep bringing yourself back to it. You can't just sort of shoot an arrow in the air and not know where it's going to land.
So is he encouraging you take the next step forward straight away? Or?
But it always has to be relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is it a bit tough because you're sort of seeing these little babies, as you call them, not able to be nurtured as you keep going on a particular journey?
I think I pride myself on being a good self-editor. I think that part of it I handled pretty well.
Yeah.
But other people don't. They think every word they write is precious. I've edited other people and they're very, very resistant to changing anything. I'm very good at taking advice.
Did it help or hinder changing genres or writing in a different way, say from the scripts for TV compared to a novel? Is that a bigger jump than it looks?
It's a huge jump. It's a huge jump. I naively thought I was always going to write a novel and all I had to do, I could write dialogue, so all I had to do was put a bit of prose in between the dialogue. It wasn't like that at all.
And is that because you don't have the TV and the imagery to back it up, or do you think it's because it's just a much longer journey than the 25
years? Yes, it's so easy to write. Everything else is happening and you just put the dialogue. You have to have a good ear for dialogue, which I do. But that's not inventing the story. That's not writing the whole story. You know, that's different.
And, of course, the script writing documents that you have to do for TV, they've got a bit of formula, haven't you? Like scene by scene, you've got to say where people are and what they're saying and what the lighting's like. It kind of forces you to stay in the moment.
Exactly right. And, I mean, in the case of series and serials television, you're really fed the story. It's a bit of a sausage machine, not to be too disparaging. And the in-house story boarding team do all the story for you, basically, in the handles. So you do. You're just a dialogue writer.
But they do the big story arcs.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. You can be inventive within that.
Yeah.
And different shows are a bit different. With Country Practice, we were invited to bring our own story, like the one about the psychologist.
And do people submit many stories out of the blue? Do they offer to contribute?
In series and serial, no. That happened very rarely. Yeah,
And is it a bit of an issue? Because you're developing the character in the novel as you go, you know, the way you want. But that's both a freedom and it's a bit of a pressure as well that you can't.
Makes it very hard. Yes, yeah. I didn't have anybody handing me the story,
exactly.
Saying here you are, exactly. Fill in with the dialogue.
Are you happy with your characters?
Yes, I am very happy with them now. Yeah.
And do you yearn to go back to the mining in Queensland? I got a sense that was kind of where the heart was a little bit.
Yeah, for a long time I did dream of going back there, because I know where the biggest sapphires in the world come from, the Anarchy gem fields, and I know there are even bigger ones there that are still there.
And you were a bit taken by first getting there and seeing where the guy on the horse had gone through the wall of the hotel.
Yeah.
Just quietly, was that you?
It was, I promise.
Okay. Leon Saunders, it's been good to talk. He's the author of The Gaze of Dogs. Pretty confronting story. I won't go into all the secret bits of it, but it's a very interesting read. Leon, thanks very much for okay, he doesn't admit it, but we all know he did it, riding that horse down from Queensland. Okay. Leon, you could have just told us about it. You really did not have to ride the horse through the studio wall. We'll do what we can to fix it. But nevertheless, it's been great to chat to you. Leon Saunders, North Shore Radio FM 91.3. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Richard.